Chapter 52. Chicken Feed. Decatur, Illinois, and Atlanta, 1995 to 1999. Howie and Devon were on the lam. He had walked out of the office at ADM on a Friday, knowing he would never return. A pack of reporters had been camped out in their driveway ever since. He and Devon started packing. They sneaked out of Decatur at dawn on Sunday on a rented prop plane to fly to Chicago, where they met family friend Don Keough, who was giving them a ride to Sun Valley on his private jet. Since reporters weren't allowed inside the Allen Conference, Howie thought they would be safe. He had been pacing the floor for 10 days, ever since Mark Whitaker, an excitable manager he knew at ADM, suddenly confessed to him that he was acting as an FBI mole. Whitaker told him that the FBI was going to arrive at Howie's house at 6 o'clock on Tuesday night for an interview. Now Howie knew why Whitaker kept showing up at work for several days in a row in the same greenish polyester suit. He had been wearing a wire. Ever since Whitaker made his confession, he'd been calling every day, blathering his anxieties at Howie, who tried to disentangle himself. Howie hadn't busted Whitaker, but he could tell from the panic in Whitaker's voice that he must be cracking under the stress. That Tuesday night, Devon tried to fix dinner with shaking hands. When the doorbell rang, Howie wanted to throw up. In came a guy in a suit who told him he was not a target. 300 FBI agents were fanned out across the country interviewing other people about price fixing of an ADM product called lysine that was used in chicken feed. Howie was terrified, but had made up his mind to be completely forthcoming with the FBI. He said he didn't trust Duane Andreas, who had put him in charge of funneling requests for political contributions, a role, given Andreas's history, that might have made anybody's stomach churn. He told the agent that the previous fall Andreas had rebuked him when he raised ethical questions about providing entertainment to a congressman. Howie didn't know anything about price fixing, however. The second the FBI agents left, Howie called his father, flailing, saying, "I don't know what to do. I don't have the facts. How do I know if these allegations are true? My name is on every press release. How can I be the spokesman for the company worldwide? What should I do? Should I resign?" Buffett refrained from the obvious response, which was that, of his three children, only Howie could have wound up with an FBI agent in his living room after taking his first job in the corporate world. He listened to the story non-judgmentally and told Howie that it was his decision whether to stay at ADM. He gave only one piece of advice. Howie had to decide within the next 24 hours. "If you stay in longer than that," he said, "you'll become one of them. No matter what happens, it will be too late to get out." That clarified things. Howie now realized that waiting was not a way to get more information to help him decide. It was making the decision to stay. He had to look at his options and understand as of right now what they meant. If he resigned, and they were innocent, he would lose friends and look like a jerk. If he stayed, and they were guilty, he would be viewed as consorting with a gang of criminals. The next day, Howie went in, resigned, and told the general counsel that he would take legal action against the company if they put his name on any more press releases. Resigning from the board was a major event. For a director to resign was like sending up a smoke signal that said the company was guilty, guilty, guilty. People at ADM did not make it easy for Howie. They pushed for reprieve. They asked how he could in effect convict them without a trial. Howie held firm, however, and got out. 2 days later, when the announcement of his resignation became public, the reporters camped out on his doorstep. The name Buffett, attached to a scandal, was like red meat to Rottweilers. The wisdom of moving fast was even more apparent now that he and Devon had to manage a getaway from their own home. But Howie soon found that despite the absence of reporters, who were excluded from the event, even Sun Valley was not safe. One of the first people he saw in the lobby of the Sun Valley Lodge was another ADM board member. This man, who would be around all weekend, poked him in the chest and said, "You've just made the biggest mistake of your life." He couldn't have been more wrong. Howie had just saved himself from being associated with a disaster in which three top executives, including the vice chairman Michael Andreas, would go to prison in the biggest price-fixing case in American history. ADM paid an enormous fine to settle with the government, and its reputation took a hit that would shadow it for years. Now, however, the contretemps had left Howie out of a job. Big Susie, who was concerned about him, and also about Susie Jr., who was getting divorced from Alan, swung into action and convinced Warren to begin a tradition of giving each of the kids $1 million once every 5 years on their birthdays, starting then. Buffett not only went along, but bragged on himself for beginning this tradition. He had begun to loosen up significantly when it came to money. Susie's allowance had expanded dramatically. At her behest, Buffett bought another house in Laguna next to the first, known as the dormitory, to house all the children and grandchildren and visitors. Susie's Pacific Heights apartment, up 1 million stairs with no elevator, but with an amazing view of the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz, had been transformed to feature white lacquered walls and carpeting in her trademark sunny yellow. Almost every inch of space was covered with things she had purchased, collected from her travels, or been given by friends. There were paintings and masks created by artist friends, a Chinese altar cloth, a Balinese tapestry, Tiffany glass, souvenirs and tchotchkes of all kinds, some expensive, many cheap and offbeat. They filled her walls, cabinets, closets, and drawers to overflowing. The effect struck observers, depending on their perspective, as colorful, beautiful, and a wonderful reflection of Susie's personality, or a chaotic magpie's nest of things. Susie was always lobbying for more space. Along with the second apartment she had convinced Warren to buy her on the ground floor of her building, unknown to him, she had also begun to rent storage rooms around San Francisco to house her ever-expanding collections. Susie's ministry to the sick and dying seemed to compound as rapidly as her collections. She had carried on her work with AIDS sufferers through the 1990s. Then her sister Dottie began a battle with terminal cancer. All through Dottie's earlier struggles, with alcoholism, with health and marital problems, with the death of her son Billy, Susie had been by her side. Susie stayed in Omaha to nurse her sister through her last months and days. When Dottie finally died, another person Susie had not, in the end, been able to save, it was the greatest loss she had suffered since her nephew's terrible death by overdose. And Susie was now the last person alive from her original family. In summer 1996, she had to help Warren deal with the death of his 92-year-old mother. Even in her later years, Lila had never stopped berating the family. She could still work Doris over on the phone or during a visit, barely stopping for breath for an hour or more, sending Doris into tears and ending with, "I'm glad we had this little talk." Warren himself continued to avoid Lila, having relegated most of the caretaking to Susie Jr. He spoke much more often and more fondly of Rose Blumkin than he ever did of his mother. When Astrid and Sharon Osberg took him out to visit Lila, he was a wreck, and the two women would talk to Warren's mother while he sat by anxiously, not participating in the conversation. As Lila's memory faded, her story mostly wound down to the 38 and a half wonderful years with Howard, and one other topic that seemed to have lodged itself in her mind during Warren's infancy. "Isn't it a shame about the little Lindbergh baby?" she would ask. "Isn't it a shame?" After Lila died, on Warren's 66th birthday, the family assembled for a funeral, their grieving complicated by a cauldron of mixed emotions. She went to rest as the person she had been. Any hopes of what she could have become had things been different went to the grave along with her. "I cried a lot when my mother died. It wasn't because I was sad and missed her. It was because of the waste. She had her good parts, but the bad parts kept me from having a relationship with her. My dad and I never talked about it, but I really regret the waste of what could have been." With both his parents gone, Warren was the senior member of his family, the watchkeeper at that thin boundary between life and death. It was his sisters, however, whose lives were most affected by Lila's death. They were surprised to find themselves inheriting a sizable amount of Berkshire stock from their mother, more than they had originally owned themselves, along with the first distribution from their father's trust set up by their brother years before. Bertie had kept all her Berkshire stock from the beginning and had her own philanthropic interests. She had always tended to contribute her energy and effort quietly, behind the scenes, and did not want to play a leading role. And Doris now had real money again for the first time since the Naked Puts debacle had wiped her out in 1987. For Doris, her mother's death was a new beginning. She set up her own foundation, the Sunshine Lady Foundation, and started her giving with the Edith Stahl Kraft Outstanding Teacher Award, named after their Aunt Edie, and modeled on the Omaha Teacher Awards, named after their Aunt Alice, that her brother's foundation gave out. Warren's sisters were now rich. Two of his children also had a little money, thanks to Susie's persuasiveness about the million-dollar birthday gifts. Buffett had never demanded an accounting of the huge amounts it took to fund Susie's largesse, although he scratched his head and wondered what on earth she did with all the money. The tax complication of the large gifts to their children, however, required that she give Warren a history of her gift-giving. He had always been proud of her generosity, although not always pleased about those who benefited from it. He was now particularly displeased by some of her larger gifts, which flew in the face of what he had understood about the nature of their marriage. His impression that she had ended her other relationship stood corrected. Despite the parallel between his own complicated personal life and Susie's, he was upset. A discussion of Susie's will ensued. They had sharply differing opinions about who among her friends should receive bequests. In the end, his decision ruled. Afterward, the Buffett bathtub memory went to work. Anything negative that had transpired between them simply vanished, and Susie was restored as his ideal, because he needed her to be. Warren had stood firm on the question of Susie's bequests to her friends, but she had gentled him enough on issues of money when it came to their children that he was not only comfortable giving them $1 million every few years while he was alive, he was going to leave them a reasonable amount of money after his death. It would not fund a zoo full of bears like William Randolph Hearst's, but they would be more than comfortable. Howie had used his first $1 million birthday gift to buy a 900-acre farm in Decatur, Illinois, where he still lived. Now he had two farms, one of which he owned outright. After the ADM lawsuit settled down, Don Keough suggested that he become a professional director by going on the board of another high-profile business, Coca-Cola Enterprises, CCE. Even though he had gained some business experience, Howie really preferred to sit on his combine working the fields, and while CCE was far more respectable than ADM, the CCE directorship, nevertheless, was a bit of a hop from the fire into the frying pan. A giant cola bottler, CCE had been smashed together out of smaller bottlers that were Coca-Cola's customers. They bought the syrup concentrate that Coke made, mixed it with fizzy water, and sold it, acting as middlemen, so their relationship with Coke was critical. Neither could live without the other. Don Keough, Buffett's old Omaha friend, was now president of Coca-Cola. His boss, the CEO of Coca-Cola, the aristocratic Cuban-born Roberto Goizueta, was revered in the business world for creating the world's best-known brand through slogans like, "Coke is it," and "I'd like to buy the world a Coke." Buffett felt that Coca-Cola had by now become a self-sustaining enterprise, and he admired Goizueta for having gotten it to this stage. In 1997, Gates joined Buffett and Goizueta on a panel discussion at Sun Valley that was moderated by Keough. "I used to talk to Bill all the time, and I'd always use this expression that a ham sandwich could run Coca-Cola. And Bill wasn't quite housebroken then. So we were sitting on this panel, up in front of the audience, and Bill said something to the effect that it's pretty easy to run Coke. I was trying to make a point about how Coke is such a wonderful business," says Gates, "and I said something about how I'm going to step down from Microsoft before I'm 60 because it's a tough business, and a young person may need to be in there to handle turns in the road. But it came across that I thought of Microsoft as exciting, and I must have said something like, unlike Coca-Cola." Goizueta thought I was an uppity, arrogant kid who was painting some kind of picture that I was engaged in some masterful act on a daily basis, whereas anybody could leave at noon and go golfing if they ran Coca-Cola. And Roberto hated Bill from that point forward. Buffett avoided technology stocks partly because these fast-moving businesses could never be run by a ham sandwich. He thought it no shame to have a business that could be run by a ham sandwich. He wanted to get Berkshire Hathaway to the point that it could be run by a ham sandwich, too, though not until after he was gone. But by 1997, Coca-Cola had started to set goals for itself that were so ambitious that it took not a ham sandwich, not even Goizueta, but a lot of financial engineering to achieve them. Coke owned 40% of CCE and tended to act as though it owned 100%. The creation of CCE by rolling up a group of bottlers had been part of a larger strategy of buying and selling bottlers in order to time the profits and boost Coca-Cola's earnings. This was neither illegal nor technically deceitful, but it was nonetheless an illusion, and Warren, who was on the board of Coke, was always aware of the potential for misrepresentation. Roberto did a lot of things operationally that were terrific, and I loved the guy. But Roberto got tangled up in promising numbers that eventually couldn't be delivered. He talked about high teens growth, 18%. Big companies are not going to increase their earnings in the high teens over long periods of time. For a while you can do it, but it just isn't in the cards to keep it up forever. I remember when he came in and talked to us about how he was going to add a third leg to earnings, which was profits made on buying and selling bottlers. He tried to sell the finance committee that this was the way of the future. The prices they paid for bottling companies were just nuts. I asked the chief financial officer all these questions, but Roberto started the board meetings at 10 o'clock and finished at noon. The atmosphere was such that it didn't lend itself to questioning. He just had a feeling when it got to be noon that it would not be at all polite to keep raising subjects or talking about things that would cause the meeting to last until 1 o'clock. He was just not a guy you questioned. Some people have that bearing about them, and when the bearing is backed up by a very good record, the combination of the two is pretty overpowering. Buffett was more than simply non-confrontational. He was of an age and from an era that viewed serving on boards as a quasi-social activity in which deference and politeness held sway. In 1998, that was the boardroom culture throughout America. This culture reflected the reality that the structure of corporate boards gave directors very little leeway with management. As a director, you can't remotely tell management what to do. All this stuff you read in the press about the board's setting strategy is baloney. As a board member, you can do practically nothing. If a CEO thinks a director is smart and on his side, he'll listen to some degree. But 98% of the time, he'll do what he wants to anyway. Listen, that's the way I run Berkshire. I think Roberto liked me, but he was not looking for a lot of ideas from me. Buffett never knew of anything seriously enough awry at Coca-Cola to make him consider the drastic step of resigning from the board. Howie had a different problem, standing up to pressure from Coca-Cola. I was more independent than just about anybody else on that board, because I was on the Berkshire board, and no one at Coca-Cola could intimidate me, says Howie. So I had no problem challenging Coca-Cola on behalf of CCE. But Howie eventually got off the CCE board. There was just too much potential for conflict between the two boards. In the sense that people learn more from heavy seas than smooth sailing, if Keogh had meant to send Howie to another crash course in business school, the CCE role was a success. Howie's radar for danger signs in business had sharpened considerably. Even though he continued to serve on boards, the experience taught him that he wanted to fulfill his thirst for excitement outside the corporate world. By the mid-1990s, Goizueta and his finance chief, Doug Ivester, were dosing Coke with even larger amounts of bottler profits to maintain the illusion of the company's rapid earnings flow. Then, in 1997, Goizueta died unexpectedly, only a few months after announcing he had lung cancer. The board and the company and investors were shocked. He had been a statesmanlike CEO, credited with making Coca-Cola an international giant, his persona so titanic that it was hard to imagine who could fill his shoes. The board had deferred to Goizueta so absolutely that nobody ever seemed to have thought of any alternative to his hand-picked successor, the burly, table-pounding Ivester. The finance chief had a big reputation. He had engineered much of the company's recent success, carving up the financial interests of Coca-Cola and its bottlers to squeeze out every last advantage in Coca-Cola's favor. Goizueta was the aristocratic leader, Ivester the hands-on doer. He loved technology and hummed along with the Silicon Valley gestalt of the times. Buffett liked Ivester and wanted him to succeed. A textile factory mechanic's son who had risen through sheer determination, Ivester was an analytical numbers guy. And, of course, under Goizueta, he had enriched Buffett enormously. He had that underdog grit that Buffett liked. Moreover, Buffett laid responsibility for the accounting gimmickry at Goizueta's door, not Ivester's. Juicing the earnings had certainly worked. Coca-Cola was trading at $70 per share. BRK itself was rocking with the market. Priced at $48,000 in June 1997, it flew to $67,000 over the next 9 months. The higher the market went, the tougher it got for Buffett to invest, and yet the higher BRK rose. It made no sense, except that the stocks that Berkshire owned were rising with the market. As 1998 progressed, the Dow crossed 9,000 and was on its way to the magic 10,000. BRK blasted through $70,000 a share. At the shareholder meeting, Buffett told investors, "Our idea of tough times is periods like now." With too much cash, too few wonderful ideas, and without calling the Aeroholic hotline, Buffett now bought a company for Berkshire called NetJets for $725 million. He sold the indefensible and became one of NetJets' customers. This company sold timeshares in jets of various makes and sizes. Its planes all had tail numbers that started with QS, or Quebec Sierra. Susie had gotten Warren to buy her a quarter share in a fractional jet from NetJets in 1995, worth 200 hours a year of flight time, which she referred to as the richly deserved. She joked that QS stood for Queen Susie. Buffett took to NetJet so much that he had appeared in an ad and endorsed it even before he bought it. Still, on the surface, it was an atypical decision for a man who would, 1 year later, tell the moguls at Sun Valley that somebody should have shot Orville down. The reasoning behind the purchase seemed sound, though. NetJets was dominant in its market. It was too late for any serious competitor to catch up. Buffett figured that it was not unlike the newspaper business, where there were no red ribbons. Eventually, the competitors would fall away. And indeed, NetJets was outgrowing the competition. Buffett was intrigued with its CEO, Richard Santulli, an entrepreneurial mathematician who had formerly spent his days at Goldman Sachs figuring out trading patterns using chaos theory mathematics. Now he used those same skills to schedule plane flights on 6 hours' notice for a database full of celebrity clients whom he entertained at private events. Buffett met a whole new set of famous people, including Arnold Schwarzenegger and Tiger Woods. Investors cheered Buffett's purchase of NetJets, but were shocked when he almost simultaneously announced that Berkshire was buying General Re, a huge insurance wholesaler, or reinsurer, which bought excess risk from other insurers. At $22 billion, this deal was almost 30 times larger than NetJets. It dwarfed by multiples his largest deal ever, Geico. When he met with the Gen Re management team, Buffett told them, "I'm strictly hands-off. You guys run your own business. I won't interfere." Then he suddenly started spouting numbers from Geico. "Well, you know, their hit ratio has dropped a bit." The hit ratio is the percentage of phone calls coming into Geico that turn into sales. "Last week their numbers were..." "Holy cow," thought Tad Montross, General Re's chief underwriter. "This is hands-off? He knows more about Geico than we know about General Re." Buffett did not know much about the inner workings of General Re. He had made the decision to buy based on studying the company's results, and he liked its reputation. General Re was sort of the Grace Kelly of the sometimes shady insurance business. General Ree wore white gloves and historically had acted more ladylike and respectable than the average company. Still, given the pattern of Buffett's purchases of insurers, in almost every case they plunged straight into the ditch shortly after he bought them, and given the size of this deal, the distant rumble of the tow truck's engine warming up could be heard, barely audible, over the next hill. But it was the high price paid for General Ree that attracted most of the attention, and the fact that Buffett had paid in stock, not cash, in effect swapping 20% of Berkshire Hathaway for General Ree in a deal announced on the day that Berkshire hit its then all-time high of $80,900 per share. People wondered if Buffett's willingness to give away his stock when it was trading at such an unheard-of price meant that he, too, thought BRK was overvalued. Buffett had spent his career tightening his stranglehold on Berkshire. Giving stock to General Ree's shareholders diluted his own personal voting interest in Berkshire from 43% to less than 38%. The last time he had paid stock for a major purchase, it was Geico, and investors had believed then that Berkshire was overpriced. So they speculated about the message Buffett's new deal might be sending. The price of BRK swung up and down based partly on the prices of the stocks that Berkshire owned. It was especially high at that moment because Berkshire owned 200 million shares of Coca-Cola, which now traded at an astronomical price. So, if Buffett was subtly signaling through his purchase of General Ree that BRK was overvalued, did that mean that its underlying stocks, like Coca-Cola, were overpriced? If so, this could have implications for the entire market. It might mean the whole market was overpriced. The king of the soft drink world, Coca-Cola ruled with an aggressive swagger, a fizzy, dizzy arrogance. Buffett's stake in KO had multiplied 14-fold over a decade to $13 billion, and he had gone so far as to declare the company an inevitable to his shareholders, as if it were a stock he would never sell. He reasoned that Coca-Cola would send more swallows down more throats in each passing decade for an investing lifetime, which made it about as close to immortal for a brand as you could get. Berkshire now owned more than 8% of the company. Coca-Cola stock was trading as high as 40 times its estimated 2000 earnings, a multiple that said investors believed the stock would keep rising by at least 20% a year. But to do that, it would have to increase earnings 25% a year for 5 years. Impossible. It would have to almost triple sales to a number nearly as large as the entire soft drink market in 1999. Again, impossible. No amount of bottler sales or accounting finagles could produce results like that. Buffett knew it. Nevertheless, he did not sell his Coca-Cola stock. The reason was partly inertia. Buffett liked to say he made most of his money by sitting on his ass. Like the investors who kept their Geico stock when it fell to $2 a share, inertia had protected him from many mistakes, both of commission and of omission. He also owned too much Coke to sell without creating a major headache. The symbolism of Warren Buffett, the world's greatest investor and a board member, dumping Coca-Cola stock would be unmistakable. The price of Coca-Cola could plunge as a result. Besides, with its effervescent mix of profit, product, nostalgia, show business, and likable people, Coca-Cola was Buffett's favorite stock. The real thing wasn't a slogan to him. It was an incredible cash machine that could grind out money forever, like the mill in the old fairy tale that endlessly ground out rivers of porridge, mountains of gold, or an ocean's worth of salt. Buffett carefully sidestepped these questions about the market and Coca-Cola when he used Berkshire stock to buy General Ree, saying, "It is not a market call whatsoever." BRK, he said, was fairly valued before the merger, and the combined companies would create synergy. When Charlie Munger was asked, he stated that Buffett had consulted him about this deal very late in the game. In effect, he disowned the deal. Not unexpectedly, investors began to reprice BRK as if either Berkshire and its holdings in stocks like Coca-Cola were overpriced, or the deal's synergies would prove illusory, or both. Buffett's explanation later that summer at Sun Valley was that, "We wanted to buy Gen Re, but coming with Gen Re was $22 billion of investments. Many were stocks. Buffett promptly sold them. Adding $22 billion of bonds changed the bond-stock ratio at Berkshire, which I was not unhappy with. It did have the effect of a portfolio allocation change. So Buffett, who sat on the Coca-Cola board with Herbert Allen, was not unhappy with swamping BRK's stocks, including Coca-Cola, in an ocean of General Re's bonds. This statement in context made all kinds of sense. In his previous shareholder letter, Buffett had written that stocks were not overvalued if interest rates stayed below average and if businesses kept delivering extraordinary returns on capital. In other words, if the unlikely continued to occur. This statement was oblique enough to avoid looking like a forecast. Buffett thought those who were always out prophesying some turn in the market's direction usually wound up being wrong 10 times out of 2. So he rarely made statements about the market, and often played coy when he did. Still, it was unusually clever of him to work the words "not overvalued" into a sentence that said that the market was overvalued. People could read this message any way they wanted, but if they were smart, they got it. Likewise, Buffett was not unhappy with diluting his stock portfolio in the same Sun Valley speech where he faced an audience filled with Internet CEOs at a time when Internet stocks were parthenogizing faster than naked mole rats. He accompanied his not unhappy with remark with the same warnings as in his letter, that interest rates must stay well below average and the economy stay unusually hot for the market to meet investors' expectations. This was also the same Sun Valley speech where Buffett had used his place at the pulpit to explain that investing is laying out money today to get money back tomorrow, like Aesop's bird in the hand versus the birds in the bush, that interest rates are the price of waiting for the birds in the bush, that for periods sometimes as long as 17 years, the market had gone exactly nowhere, and that at other times, such as the present, the value of stocks grows much faster than the economy. And, of course, he had closed this speech by comparing investors to a bunch of oil prospectors who were going to hell. Thus, if Buffett was reshuffling his portfolio and focusing on bonds, perhaps it meant that he thought that it was now easier to make a living in bonds than stocks, and it was going to get easier still. The following October, he made another move that was just the opposite of what most people were doing, strikingly conservative by the standards of the market. He bought Mid-American Energy Holding Company, an Iowa-based utility company with some international operations and a presence in alternative energy. He put in enough capital to buy just over 75% of Mid-American for about $2 billion, plus $7 billion of assumed debt, with the other 25% owned by his friend Walter Scott, Mid-American CEO Scott's protege, David Sokol, and Sokol's number two, Greg Abel. Investors were mystified. Why would Buffett want to buy a regulated electric company? Admittedly, the business was growing moderately, was well managed, and had attractive embedded returns that were relatively certain and would be so for as long as could reasonably be imagined. Buffett saw this as a second cornerstone for Berkshire alongside the insurance business. He felt that he was working with excellent managers who could potentially put a lot of money to work in utilities and energy at predictable rates of return, which compensated for the limited growth. However, Buffett was already being ridiculed for his refusal to buy technology stocks. Now he had bought the light company. How dull! But this was not how he thought. When it came to investing, the kind of electricity he sought was not the thrill of trading, but rather kilowatts. Buying Mid-American and General Re significantly diluted the impact of Coca-Cola on Berkshire's shareholders, but Berkshire still owned 200 million shares of Coke. Buffett never stopped thinking about Coca-Cola, where matters continued to go awry. By late 1999, the value of his KO stock was down to $9.5 billion, dragging down the price of BRK with it. A short-term wobble didn't worry him. It never did. But thanks in large part to Coca-Cola, one share of BRK stock could no longer buy a top-of-the-line luxury sports car. Buffett kept turning over and over in his mind an incident back in June. Reports had trickled in that Coke products were poisoning children in Belgium and France. It was not hard to figure out what to do. The late Goizueta would have let Mr. Coca-Cola, Don Keogh, handle it. Fly over right away, visit the kids, shower the parents with free soft drinks, make compassionately clever remarks to the press. Instead, Ivester, who was actually in France at the time, returned to the U.S. without comment, leaving the local bottlers to deal with the mess. Herbert Allen, never one to sit patiently on the sidelines, called Ivester and asked, "Why on earth don't you get over there and show your face?" And Ivester said, "I've sent a team over. Plus, those kids aren't really sick." Allen exploded in frustration. "Look," he said, "these aren't kids who marched around and said, 'I'm going to get Coca-Cola by saying I'm sick.' They think they're sick. Whether they're sick or not, what harm would it do to go over and sit down with their parents and give them a lifetime supply of Coke?" But it seemed to him that Ivester didn't understand any of that. As he saw it, Coca-Cola was not at fault. And that was that. For weeks, the local bottlers kept trying to reassure the public that Coca-Cola products were safe. But then it turned out that maybe they weren't. The company admitted it had found mold and chemical contaminants in the bottling plants, but it insisted these were aberrations, surely not serious enough to sicken children. Buffett was horrified. The arrogant response played right into Coca-Cola's vainglorious image. Ivester had already had difficulty dealing with the European Union. Coca-Cola's uber-American style and the company's strategy of seeking exclusive marketing deals had earned it a reputation for extraordinary hubris. Over and over, European government officials slapped around Coca-Cola representatives in a Punch and Judy show. All over the world, headlines blared, and customers' trust in their beloved product dwindled. Weeks later, Ivester showed up in Europe and apologized in finely crafted legalese that never actually said, "We're sorry." The headlines died, and the Coke machines were plugged back in all over the continent. But the incident cost more than $100 million and impossible-to-measure damage to Coke's reputation. Buffett stewed. Herbert Allen was stewing as well. Closer to the day-to-day management of the company, he questioned whether Coca-Cola was running off the rails. Despite the declining sales, at least 3,500 new employees had marched into Coca-Cola Plaza in Atlanta in the last 2 years. Allen looked at the burgeoning payroll and saw a cancerous growth on the company. The company's strategy of adding on the periphery, growing by acquisition, and hiring thousands of new staff was not working. Quarter after quarter, Ivester promised to improve growth rates. Quarter after quarter, Coca-Cola fell short. One day in Ivester's office, Allen asked him, "What are you going to do?" And Ivester said he didn't know, had no solution. It had just overwhelmed him. Everything together had overwhelmed him. He did not know what to do, Allen says. Floating above it all, like the Goodyear blimp, was Coca-Cola's millennially named Project Infinity. This was one of those projects where everybody's computer would be linked up to the men's room so they'd know how much soap they were taking out of the dispensers, says Allen. Even the name, Project Infinity, seemed to refer to out-of-control spending in pursuit of ever-diminishing returns. It drove Allen nuts. He wanted to know what Coca-Cola was getting for its $1 billion. How was Infinity going to solve the company's basic problems? Buffett was displeased, but resigned to being displeased. He had encountered this on some scale at almost every company where he sat on the board. Therefore, he sighed to himself, they all do it. The people who run information technology departments always want the latest and greatest whiz-bang thing. No matter how smart you are, no matter how much you know, who can challenge them? We probably aren't going to sell any more Coca-Cola because of some computer project, and we will add more people instead of cutting jobs. The vendors have it rigged to make us update the software and hardware every couple of years, or the system will stop working, so it isn't even a one-time expense. Controlling technology spending is one of the toughest problems in management, and it's particularly hard at Coca-Cola because a successful company is like a rich family. When you're prosperous, it's very hard to instill discipline. Buffett, of course, did not run his own company or his own rich family that way. And there was more disturbing news via Don Keogh, who remained the bottler's best friend at Coca-Cola. He was now retired from the company and had become chairman of Allen & Company, but Goizueta had kept him on as an advisor to the board. Keough was almost as much a part of Coca-Cola as he ever had been. Through Keough, Buffett heard that Ivester had been dictating terms to the bottlers in an unheard-of way. This troubled him, because so much of the good results produced by Ivester had come from re-engineering the relationship between the bottlers and Coca-Cola. Now Ivester was pushing that same lever so hard that the century-long partnership between the company and the bottlers had broken down. Don Keough had become a sort of father-confessor to the disaffected among the bottlers. They were in open revolt. Meanwhile, Ivester had snatched away Keough's official role, a dumb move since Ivester needed Keough on his side. He might be King Arthur, but Keough was Coca-Cola's Merlin and must be paid due respect. This squeezing of the bottlers reiterated the question of whether Ivester really knew what to do about Coca-Cola's slowing sales growth. The philosophy at Coca-Cola had always been that it was all about the relationship with the customer. Ivester favored a continuation of the accounting solutions to business problems, troweling more makeup on Coke when the CEO's main job, as Keough and Allen and Buffett perceived it, was to make the Coke brand more popular around the world. Since Goizueta had been engineering the company's earnings before he died, and Ivester was the engineer and reaped the rewards for doing so, why should he behave any differently now that he was CEO? As one board member put it, the finance committee was the center of everything, which was odd for a marketing company like Coca-Cola. In the end, the mistake was not Ivester's. The board had deferred to Goizueta even after his death, when it followed his wishes and made the head of the financial engineering department the new CEO of Coke. Still, Buffett was pretty sure that the problem so obvious to him was not so obvious to the whole board. As he ticked off marks against Ivester, Buffett spent the whole fall in a wrung-out state of anxiety. By Thanksgiving, the paralyzing limitations of his role as a board member, given the travails of Coca-Cola, had almost reached a breaking point. Then Fortune magazine, which had labeled Ivester the 21st century CEO not 2 years earlier, published a highly critical piece blaming him for the company's problems. That was a bad sign. Fortune rarely smiled on CEOs whom Fortune smacked around this way, especially if the CEO had previously been featured in a flattering profile on the cover of the magazine. Being knocked off one's pedestal in public this way signaled that the powerful people whom Fortune's reporters used as sources were displeased and on the brink of tossing away the teddy bear they had once embraced. Right after Thanksgiving, Herbert Allen put in a call to Buffett. "I think we have a problem with Ivester," he said. "We picked the wrong guy." Buffett agreed. "That's about it," said Allen. They began to lay their plans. They both estimated that it would take more than a year for the board to come around to their point of view that Ivester had to go. "And that," says Allen, "would have been devastating to the company. So I think we decided, just as two individuals, to tell him the truth about how we felt." Allen called Ivester and said he and Buffett wanted a meeting. They agreed to get together in Chicago, where Ivester would be stopping following a meeting with McDonald's. On a cool, cloudy Wednesday, the first day of December, 1999, Buffett and Allen flew into Chicago. Ivester's well-known obstreperousness kindled Buffett's dread of confrontation. He lashed down his anxiety, turtling into his shell. Later, it was reported that he appeared cold. The three men got down to business without preamble. Impersonally, Buffett and Allen told Ivester that they appreciated his efforts on behalf of Coca-Cola, but he no longer had their confidence. Still, Ivester was not actually fired. Buffett and Allen lacked the authority to fire Ivester. "He might have won a board vote, and he knew that," Buffett says. Ivester took the news stoically. He rushed back to Atlanta to call an emergency telephone board meeting for 4 days later, leaving the mystified board to wait in suspense. On Sunday, Ivester told the board members that he had concluded that he was not the right person to run the company. He would step down immediately. This was exactly as Buffett and Allen had hoped. But he also said there would be no transition. He was leaving as of that day. As the board listened in stunned silence, he described it as a voluntary decision. And that was true. in the sense that it is voluntary to avoid the firing squad by walking the plank. Board members began asking what had happened. Was he sick? Was something terribly wrong at Coca-Cola? Why didn't they have any warning? Must the transition be so sudden? Ivester never wavered from his script. A while back, the board had insisted, against some resistance, that Ivester put a name in an envelope that said who should succeed him if he were hit by a truck. The envelope was now open to reveal the name of Doug Daft, head of Coca-Cola's Middle and Far Eastern divisions. Daft was halfway out the door to retirement, but the board, among them Buffett and Allen, instantly made him Ivester's successor, with apparently no serious discussion of any alternative. The recriminations began as the market took a hatchet to the stock. Investors had figured out that Ivester was walking the plank. In private conversations with a few board members, he let on what had happened. The board now realized, with varying degrees of outrage, how much their role had been usurped. With the media howling, it became clear that the company had better become more forthcoming. Fortune wrote an exclusive piece revealing details of the secret Chicago meeting. Ivester had negotiated a staggering $115 million consolation package, which angered both his detractors and his supporters. It gave the impression that he was either paid off or wronged, and observers now realized that an inner circle ruled the Coke board. It was carried out badly, except that there wasn't anything better that we could have carried out. It was almost a disaster the way we did it, but if we hadn't, it would have been a disaster for sure. I don't think we could have gotten the board to vote to make a change like that. Bingo. I think the only way to have made a change fast is the way we did it, and it took both of us to get it done. If either of us had done it individually, it wouldn't have happened. But by year-end, Buffett's reputation was suffering in an even more overt way, because the biggest, most profitable feat of stock selection that he had ever made, Coca-Cola, was down by one-third after Ivester's departure. That Buffett had felt forced to intervene in a particularly graceless way, which had backfired in public on both the company and himself, left the impression not that he had ridden to the rescue, as with Solomon, but that what he and Herbert Allen had done was the meddling of a couple of old men. That impression compounded the worries raised when the biggest acquisition he had ever made, General Re, coughed up a nasty surprise within days after Berkshire closed the purchase. Ron Ferguson, the CEO, had called to say that the company had been duped out of $275 million in an enormous, elaborately designed fraud called Unicover. Investors had been surprised, to say the least, when the first report Buffett gave them about General Re was an apology for this foolish thing, as well as an expression of confidence in Ferguson and the prediction that affairs would be righted. Since there had been concerns from the beginning about whether Buffett had bought General Re only to dilute his large positions in stocks like Coca-Cola, decades of blissful confidence in his judgment about buying businesses suddenly began to waver. Even some of his most devoted believers were questioning his wisdom as the stock market's repudiation of Buffett's Sun Valley Manifesto grew even louder in the last few months of 1999. That December, he continued to look not just wrong about technology stocks, but dead wrong, and, at last, stubbornly blind to the obvious. The Dow closed the year up 25%. The Nasdaq blasted through 4,000 points, up an incredible 86%. The market valued Berkshire, with its burgeoning coffers of cash, at only $56,100 per share now, for a total market capitalization of $85 billion. That compared poorly to a little online media company called Yahoo, which had quadrupled in the last year. Yahoo, which captured the spirit of the times in its name, was now valued at $115 billion. As 1999 spun to a close, there was no doubt who was important and influential at the turn of the millennium, and even less doubt who was not. Time magazine crowned Amazon.com's Jeff Bezos as its Person of the Year, comparing him in importance to Queen Elizabeth, Charles Lindbergh, and Martin Luther King Jr. Buffett's personal ranking had dropped on the annual taking stock lists, which multiplied a thousandfold that year with the millennial summings up and retrospectives. He had just fallen from being the second richest to the fourth richest man in the world. Technophiles reveled in pointing out the great investor's feet of clay, saying that if Buffett headed a mutual fund, he'd be looking at a second career. Barron's, a weekly must-read on Wall Street, put him on its cover with the accompanying headline, "Warren, what's wrong?" and the comment that Berkshire stock had stumbled badly. He might as well have had a bullseye painted on his brow. In public, Buffett repeated constantly, in almost unvarying terms, the ideas that had made him famous: the margin of safety, the circle of competence, Mr. Market's vagaries. He still maintained that a stock is a piece of business, not a bunch of numbers on a screen. All through the market's dizzy rise, he refrained from arguing or disputing any of the madness, except for making his now famous speech at Sun Valley. People thought, from the way he disciplined every syllable that exited his mouth, that he was above the criticism. "Never," he said, when asked if it bothered him when people called him a has-been. "Nothing bothers me like that. You can't do well in investing unless you think independently. And the truth is, you are neither right nor wrong because people agree with you. You're right because your facts and reasoning are right. In the end, that's what counts." But these were separate issues. While he had no problem thinking independently, he was indeed miserable over being called a has-been. Asked around then if being in the public eye for decades helped keep the criticism in perspective, Buffett paused for a long while. "No, it never gets easier," he said soberly. "It always hurts just as much as the first time." But he could not do a thing about it. Buffett had spent his whole career competing in a contest that was impossible to win. No matter how much money he made, and no matter how long he kept it up, sooner or later he would have a bad year, or the momentum would slow down. He knew that. Over and over he had warned investors that trees don't grow to the sky, but that had never stopped him from climbing as fast as he could. And he had loved the climb, but somewhat to his surprise, there was no blue ribbon waiting at the top. His life was fascinating, his business accomplishments important, the principles through which he had succeeded worthy of study. So far as could be determined, everyone who knew him personally liked the man. His kaleidoscope personality perpetually revealed new facets, yet remained faithful at its core to his inner scorecard. The one thing that he would always be the best at was being himself. As he did every year, Buffett spent the holidays with Susie and the family at their vacation home in Emerald Bay, the house garlanded with Christmas decorations from Susie's huge collection. His work life may have been particularly challenging then, but Christmas of 1999 was a good one for his family. Warren was satisfied with the way his kids were maturing. Howie had settled down into life as a middle-aged farmer and successful businessman. Big Susie had gotten him interested in photography. Now he lived on an airplane half the time, photographing dangerous wild animals, his love of living on the edge channeled into getting bitten by a cheetah and chased by a polar bear. A full-time mother of two children, an unpaid part-time assistant to her father, Susie Jr. had followed in her mother's footsteps to become a major force in Omaha philanthropy, serving on the boards of the Children's Theater, the Children's Museum, and Girls Incorporated. Her ex-husband, Alan, ran the Buffett Foundation, and the two lived a few blocks apart and shared parenting. After his divorce, Peter had married Jennifer Heil and was still living in Milwaukee and writing music. In the early 1990s, he had gotten the opportunity to move to Hollywood and work in the entertainment industry. But, "I realized if I moved to L.A., he says, "I'd be one of thousands of me's out there trying to get work. My father was always into the movie The Glenn Miller Story. Glenn Miller searched and searched to find his sound. My father used to always talk about finding your sound." Peter stayed in Milwaukee rather than going to L.A., and felt that his father understood the resemblance to his choice to come back to Omaha to do things his way rather than staying in New York. Soon after, Peter was hired to compose and produce the soundtrack for an important PBS documentary, the 8-part 500 Nations. He had also written and produced a multimedia show as a benefit performance for Susie Jr. that became a PBS special and toured with it for 11 weeks. Howie had been working on Big Susie, convincing her that the kids were mature enough, saying, "Give us a chance. The money is there. Give us the chance to do something with it." That Christmas, Susie Jr., Howie, and Peter were shocked to receive 500 shares of Berkshire stock in foundations that each could manage and give to any causes they chose. The kids were elated. Susie Jr. called it gigantic. The family settled in for New Year's Eve. You could follow the progress of the millennium's arrival on television, starting in the Kiribati Islands. From Sydney to Beijing to London, millions of people celebrated on streets and beaches as a chain of fireworks shot around the globe. The Eiffel Tower's millennium clock broke down, but as the hours ticked by, nothing disastrous happened anywhere, even at General Re and Coca-Cola. There was a mathematical neatness to the progression of time zones, locations, hours that Buffett liked. After the stressful fall he had just spent, the change in millennium was not exciting to him. It was relaxing, and he needed that. Part 6. Claim Checks. Chapter 53. The Genie. Omaha, 1998. Buffett was always wary of falling into what Munger called the shoe button complex, pontificating on any and all subjects merely because he was an expert on business. But by the mid-1990s, both he and Munger were starting to receive and answer more and more questions about the business of life. He often treated the athletes and college students to whom he periodically spoke to the fable of the genie. When I was 16, I had just two things on my mind, girls and cars, Buffett would say, taking a little poetic license here by leaving out the part about the money. I wasn't very good with girls, so I thought about cars. I thought about girls, too, but I had more luck with cars. Let's say that when I turned 16, a genie had appeared to me, and that genie said, Warren, I'm going to give you the car of your choice. It'll be here tomorrow morning with a big bow tied on it, brand new, and it's all yours. Having heard all the genie stories, I would say, what's the catch? And the genie would answer, there's only one catch. This is the last car you're ever going to get in your life, so it's got to last a lifetime. If that had happened, I would have picked out that car. But you can imagine, knowing it had to last a lifetime, what would I do with it? I would read the manual about 5 times. I would always keep it garaged. If there was the least little dent or scratch, I'd have it fixed right away because I wouldn't want it rusting. I would baby that car because it would have to last a lifetime. That's exactly the position you are in concerning your mind and body. You only get one mind and one body, and it's got to last a lifetime. Now, it's very easy to let them ride for many years, but if you don't take care of that mind and that body, they'll be a wreck 40 years later, just like the car would be. It's what you do right now, today, that determines how your mind and body will operate 10, 20, and 30 years from now. Chapter 54. Semicolon. Omaha, January to August 2000. Buffett began the first week of the millennium in his office. In its first edition of the year, the Sunday Times of London said, "Ignoring technology seems to have made a chimp out of Buffett." One of the first pieces of correspondence was an email from Ron Ferguson, CEO of General Re. Buffett was already bracing himself. General Re had so far brought him nothing but deplorable news. A year ago, after the company had admitted being duped in the Unicover fraud mere weeks after Berkshire bought it, Ferguson had made a new confession. Movie producers and their lenders had talked General Re into guaranteeing ticket sales on Hollywood films. The company said it would pay if the box office fell short, without knowing what scripts would be filmed or who would star in them. Buffett had been incredulous when he found out. Within weeks, lawsuits began to unreel from the film finance fiasco faster than the failed film's credits unfurled. It could have gone without saying that his favorite manager, the brilliant Ajit Jain, would never have guaranteed any dumb movie deals, although it did get said. Then Ferguson belabored him into a nitpicking match over how to underwrite an internet lottery called Grab.com that Ajit was reinsuring. Buffett now realized that Ferguson had a sharply different philosophy from his. Buffett always liked to talk about how he would rather step over 1-foot bars than look for 7-foot bars to hurdle. The Grab.com lottery deal offered an easy profit, a 1-foot bar to step over. Ferguson didn't want to do it because it was such a layup. General Ree, he said, only did deals where it had an underwriting edge. Buffett roundhoused the match to an end, then decided that he needed a change in management. Yet he did not act, for nothing required him to do so. General Ree had a wonderful track record. The business needed mending, not a purge. Firing Ferguson so soon after he bought the company would mean a brouhaha, a public hullabaloo. He hated firing people. 2 months after the Grab.com deal, come the millennium, Ferguson was confessing that General Ree had lost another $273 million from bad insurance pricing. It struck Buffett that he could no longer hope these were isolated mistakes, but an infestation. General Ree seemed cursed since the day he'd announced he had bought the damn thing. In its first 12 months as part of Berkshire, General Ree, formerly a paragon of discipline, had run straight into the ditch and had lost nearly $1.5 billion from underwriting, the pricing and selection of risk. No company that Buffett had ever owned had lost money approaching a fraction of this magnitude. Buffett said little, but recognized that he would have to do something soon. When the news was published, investors rapidly readjusted their thinking once again. Had paying $22 billion for General Ree been a mistake? Buffett's reputation took another hit. Meanwhile, at Coca-Cola, despite the change in management, all was not well. Its new CEO, Doug Daft, had laid off 6,000 people in January as his opening act. Investors reacted with shock. Only a minority on Wall Street had been pointing out the sediment rising in Coke's river of profits, and investors were not yet convinced they were right. So Coca-Cola got socked, and along with it, BRK, already cheap at $56,100 on January 1st, started to plummet. Two weeks later, on February 9th, in the early morning sanctuary of his office, Buffett sat with half an eye fixed on CNBC, sorting through his reading. The hotline on the credenza behind his desk rang. Only Buffett answered this phone. He picked it up instantly. Jim McGuire, who traded BRK on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, was on the other end. It was a short conversation. Yep. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not now. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. Click. McGuire was calling to tell him that sell orders were pouring in for BRK. While Buffett had been playing bridge online the previous evening, an internet bulletin board writer on Yahoo, who went by ZX1675, had posted, "Warren in hospital. Critical." Over the next few hours, the rumor spread virally from posters like Hyper Pumper Full of Crap, who said over and over, "Buffett old and weak, sell," and "Sell, sell, 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 sell." With the rumors filtering through Wall Street and convincing people that Buffett was in the hospital in critical condition, BRK was trading heavily and getting hammered. Buffett's personal phone line started ringing. It had been an unusually busy morning for calls. He answered it himself, as usual, lighting up with a big grinning, "Oh, hi," to show he was happy to hear from the caller. "How are you?" the caller inquired, with a slight tone of urgency. "Well, never better." If a tornado were barreling straight toward Kiewit Plaza, Buffett would say that things were never better before mentioning the twister. People knew to read his tone of voice. Today it sounded stressed. All morning, callers had wanted to know, how was he really? "I'm fine," Buffett explained. "Everything is fine, really." But from the way BRK was trading, people were listening to Hyper Pumper Full of Crap. This was the power of new media. As BRK continued sliding on rumors of Buffett's impending demise, shareholders were ringing their brokers, demanding to know whether Buffett was alive. People who knew Buffett grilled them. Are you certain? Have you seen him? How can you know for sure? CNBC broadcast the rumors about Buffett's possible demise, flambeing the story with word of his reassurances. Skepticism grew. If he was saying he was fine, he must not be. A second rumor began to circulate that he was taking advantage of the situation to buy Berkshire's own stock cheap. That hit him on the tender spot where his reputation for personal integrity collided with his reputation for ruthless rapacity. For 2 days, the siege continued while BRK traded down more than 5%. By presuming his indispensability, the rumor paid Buffett a sort of inverted compliment. But he was outraged that anyone would think he would cheat his own shareholders by buying back stock at their expense under false pretenses. And he hated being blackmailed by some jerk who manipulated the stock price through the internet. He couldn't stand being a dog on anyone's leash. He was appalled at the thought that responding to manipulation would reward and encourage more rumors, and thereby set a precedent. Eventually, he reasoned, the rumors would die under their own demonstrated falsity. But eventually could take a long time. A new reality had dawned. In the age of the internet, time was compressed, and he had less and less control over public perception of him. Finally, he capitulated and issued an extraordinary press release. Recently, certain rumors have surfaced on the internet regarding share repurchases and Mr. Buffett's health. While it has been a long-standing Berkshire policy not to comment on rumors, we are making an exception with respect to these recent rumors. All rumors regarding share repurchases and Mr. Buffett's health are 100% false. The announcement was useless. BRK plunged 11% that week and didn't recover. On March 9th, Newsday hit the stands quoting Harry Newton, publisher of Technology Investor magazine. "I'll tell you what Warren Buffett should say when he releases his statement to shareholders. I'm sorry, that's what." The next day, BRK hit a low of $41,300 per share, trading at scarcely more than the value at which its pieces were carried on its books. The legendary Buffett premium, the high price the stock supposedly traded at just because of Buffett, was gone. The day before, the NASDAQ index had bounded up the Andes to reach 5,000. Since January 1999, it had doubled, its component stocks increasing more than $3 trillion in value. The contrast was too sharp to leave alone. A money manager wrote that investors like Buffett were fallen angels, disgraced with poor rankings, made obsolete in 1999 by mavericks who say the old laws of investing have been repealed, and backed up their theories with eye-popping numbers. Buffett was miserable about the bad publicity, though he never considered changing his investment strategy. Owners of BRK apparently would have been better off investing in an index of the market over the past 5 years, the most prolonged drought in Berkshire's history. His Coke investment, once valued at a frothy $17.5 billion, would now fetch only $8.75 billion. His determination not to give up his margin of safety meant that Berkshire had piled up billions in unused capital, which was loafing in low-yielding bonds. Buffett understood the basics of computers perfectly well, but he would not consider buying a technology stock at any price. "When it comes to Microsoft and Intel," he said, "I don't know what that world will look like 10 years from now, and I don't want to play in a game where the other guy has an advantage. The software business is not within my circle of competence. We understand dilly bars and not software." In February 2000, the SEC had denied Berkshire Hathaway's request to keep some of its stock holdings confidential. It weighed the various interests of investors in a stable market versus the right to know, and ruled in favor of the right to know. Instead of accumulating a huge block of stock like American Express or Coca-Cola, he would only have time to tweezer up stocks in little bits before people could ride his coattails. Although he would continue to fight back, the SEC had turned him into Ben Graham, who opened up his books for the whole world to see. From now on, acquiring entire businesses, which had always been his favorite way to use capital anyway, would be the main use of money at Berkshire. It was going to become much harder to put large amounts of money to work in stocks. That stung at a time when the media referred to Buffett as formerly the world's greatest investor. On March 10th, the day after Harry Newton said that Buffett should apologize, the Wall Street Journal wrote that almost everyone was making money in tech except the stubborn, curmudgeonly Buffett, whose stock was down 48% from its high. The Journal compared his performance to a retired AT&T employee whose portfolio was up 35%, saying that this technology stock dabbler isn't exactly Warren Buffett, thank goodness. Never in Buffett's career had resolution and clear thinking been put to the kind of test that he had endured for the past 3 years. Every indication in the market said that he was wrong. Because of his determined clinging to a set of moldy ideas, the public, the media, and even some of his own shareholders thought he was corked. He had only his inner conviction to steer him straight. And this was the needy man who over the years had grown habituated to a stream of accolades as steady as his daily dose of cherry coke, who was so sensitive to public criticism that he ran from anything that would expose him to it, who had sculpted his life around managing his reputation, and who fought like a tiger against anything that could sully it. Yet even under siege to his reputation, this time Buffett never fought back. He neither wrote editorials, nor testified before Congress about the dangers of the market, nor dueled in the press, nor gave television interviews to defend himself, nor arranged that his proxies do so on his behalf. He and Munger carried on their regular dialogue with Berkshire's shareholders, saying that while the market was overvalued, they could not predict how long it would last. Finally, not for the record, but as a warning and a way of teaching, Buffett explained his views once and for all and predicted that the market would fall far short of investors' hopes for 2 decades in a tour de force of a speech to the elite at Sun Valley that he shortly afterward turned into a fortune article for Joe and Jane Investor on the street. It had taken one great surge of courage to burst past his fears and beg for help from Nick Brady to save Solomon, but to show such restraint, then commit himself to such a forecast in the face of years of criticism and ridicule, took a different kind of courage, making the internet bubble one of the greatest personal challenges of his career. On March 11th, 24 hours after the Wall Street Journal said thank goodness the retired AT&T employee was a better investor than Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway issued its annual report, and Buffett graded himself a D for failing to invest Berkshire's capital. He did not say, however, that he considered avoiding technology stocks to have been a mistake. He simply reframed investors' expectations, writing that, because of its enormous size, Berkshire was now likely to grow in value only modestly better than the market. This, he knew, would set off debates about what modestly meant, but he felt it had to be said. Separately, Buffett announced that BRK was so cheap that Berkshire would now entertain offers from investors to buy its own stock. To do so, to give money back to shareholders to whom he hadn't paid a dividend in decades, to even contemplate it, was as if Buffett, a glutton for capital all his life, had suddenly turned ascetic. And for the second time, Buffett was publicly announcing what he wanted to buy in advance. Not since the great unwinding of the partnership in 1970 had he said, "I will buy Berkshire Hathaway." Once again, investors had to ask themselves which side to play. This time, many people understood the message. His willingness to put up money for Berkshire stock made such a statement that, before he could buy a single share, BRK rose 24%. The following week, the NASDAQ, full of technology stocks, sent up a warning plume of ash. By late April, it had cratered 31%, among the largest losses in historic terms. By Easter, Buffett did not care. He was doubled over in pain. He could not believe it. Right before his all-important shareholder meeting, the critical performance of his year, the rumors about his health had come true. Susie Jr. rushed him to the hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning, where he spent the next several days trying to pass a kidney stone. The nurses kept wandering in and out, addressing him as Bill. Although he was in such agony that he never asked, he wondered what the hell was going on. He phoned Big Susie repeatedly in panic. She was away in Grand Lake, Colorado, with her group of hen friends from high school. There was nothing she could do. Finally, he felt somewhat better, so his doctor sent him home. When his daughter picked him up, she explained that the nurses had been calling him Bill because he'd been registered under Doc Thompson's name. Almost immediately, however, Buffett had to rush back to the hospital, still trying to pass the damn kidney stone. Once again, he sat up all night drinking tumblers of water until, finally, the water torture worked. But from then on, he had to worry about a part of his anatomy that had not previously concerned him, because kidney stones recur. The plumbing thing. I hate it. Basically, that's what goes wrong as you get older, he said. He took inventory of his problems. The stock was in such disrepute that only his offer to buy it himself had saved it. General Ree, his largest deal, seemed cursed. Coca-Cola was nagging at his thoughts. How could so much damage have happened so quickly in a business with such a bulletproof brand? Could it really all be poor old Ivester's fault? And now a problem with his health had reared up to stare him in the face. The fact of mortality dwelled beneath the surface of Buffett's bathtub memory, periodically sliding its way back up into the tub. He had still never come to terms with his father's death. He had never decided on a suitable memorial to Howard. He had moved the large portrait of Howard so that it hung on the wall behind his desk, floating above his own head. Howard's papers sat in the basement of his house, untouched. Warren could not bring himself to go through them. He teared up if he even thought about it, obviously terrified to let the emotions that had been held back all these 35 years erupt. He'd warned that trees don't grow to the sky. Some day everything must end. Yet he himself couldn't face the day he would have to draw the line under his career and say, "This is it. I'm done. The Sistine Chapel is finished. No further brushstroke will improve it. Any further effort will produce an ordinary result." He was 69 years old. He couldn't believe that he was 69 years old. He still felt like a young man. He comforted himself with the knowledge that decades remained until he reached the age at which his mother had died. General Ree would be fixed, and Coca-Cola, as he knew, could be run by a ham sandwich. The kidney stone? Whoosh! The bathtub memory went to work. He returned to preparing for his shareholder meeting, which had become the happiest week of his year.